It's my honor this morning to introduce a simply wonderful historian, Dr. David Berger, who's the head of the Jewish Studies Department at Yeshiva College at Yeshiva University, as well as the dean of Yeshiva University's Bernard Revel Graduate School. Dr. Berger was previously the Brooklundian Professor of History at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference, as well as The Jewish-Christian Debate in the High Middle Ages. Dr. Berger is an expert on interfaith dialogue, and I commend you all to our session this afternoon with him and Rabbi Soloveitchik, together with myself, on that topic, as well as medieval Jewish-Christian debate. Dr. Berger has written analyses of Dominus Isis, Nostra Aetate, and Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's Confrontation. Won't you please welcome Professor David Berger.
Actually, if it were Isis, it would have to be Domina Isis. It's Dominus Jesus, actually. We don't want to confuse Jesus with an ancient Egyptian goddess. I'm sorry, I didn't say anything that was worth hearing anyway. Actually, I didn't do this on purpose, but this does lead into a line that a mechutin of mine, who sometimes speaks publicly, sometimes uses. He claims that he was about to speak, and he asked, "Can you hear me in the back?" And someone said, "No." At which point, someone in the front got up and said, "Can I change places with you?" So, anyway, I will try to end in less than an hour because, you know, it's one thing if the next event is a speaker, it's something quite different when the next event is lunch. I had a classmate at Yeshiva who was talking about how he was not especially looking forward to the world to come, which he described as a shear with no recess and no lunch. So I don't want to impose this otherworldly reality on you. And so I will try to end in less than an hour, though probably not exactly at 12:15. I don't know. We'll see. The issue of secular learning, the legitimacy of secular learning, is a major theme in the intellectual history of the Jews, beginning more or less in the medieval period. There are things that can be said about the Talmudic period on this issue, the curse against someone who would teach his son Greek wisdom, but as a major motif in Jewish history, this is something that starts in the Middle Ages. To many contemporary audiences, I would say to most contemporary audiences that do not consist to a significant degree of Orthodox Jews, this is a very strange question to raise in the first place. What can be wrong with studying things? But in Jewish tradition, and I mean, there are other traditions that have similar issues. There are similar issues in the history of Islam, and even to a somewhat lesser extent, the history of medieval Christianity. In Judaism, there is a value which is the highest value, and that is the study of Torah. Studying other things is problematic on those grounds alone. One should presumably spend all of one's time studying Torah. There is a Talmudic passage in which an obscure rabbi or Jew asks a rabbinic figure, who is a relative of his, "What about me, who has studied the entire Torah? May I study Greek wisdom?" And the answer is that there is a verse that says that you should study Torah day and night. Find a time which is neither day nor night, and then you can study Greek wisdom. And so there you have this issue, the issue of bitul Torah, of not studying Torah when you are studying something else. Now, obviously, the intent of this answer is that you shouldn't study Greek wisdom. This did not prevent some later Jews from saying that this means you can study Greek wisdom in places where you're not allowed to study Torah, such as the bathroom, or that you're allowed to study Torah during twilight, when it is neither day nor night, which is, after all, literally what the answer was. Find a time which is neither day nor night, and then you can study Greek wisdom. Beyond that, in the Middle Ages especially, there's another issue, and that's the issue of heresy, an issue that is even more problematic, obviously, than simply not studying Torah. Now, medieval Jews developed along two tracks. Now, this is an oversimplification, even a major oversimplification. But there are Ashkenazic Jews, primarily the Jews of northern, what we would call northern France and Germany, and as we've just heard, although this is considerably less important for our purposes because it was an intellectually less important community, England. There was a Sephardic track, which if we want to project it back before anyone would have called it Sephardic, could be said to begin already in Gaonic Babylonia, as Jews called it, with Rav Saadia Gaon, and continuing into medieval Spain under Islam and beyond. Now, the differences there have a very great deal to do, maybe almost everything to do, with the surrounding environment. The Jews of Spain under Islam lived in a stimulating environment, in an area where non-Jews around them were engaged in cultural activities that both stimulated and challenged Jews and could not readily be ignored. Now, defining that culture is an interesting challenge in itself. On the one hand, there is a kind of neutral space. That is, there is a cultural arena that is not specifically Islamic and not specifically Jewish, and for that matter, not specifically Christian. There is poetry, which is a major activity in that culture, much of it secular poetry. Now, you could say that secular poetry impinges on religion in the sense that some of the themes were not especially palatable to very pious people. But there is nothing, there's nothing Muslim about Arabic secular poetry in Spain in the 11th and 12th centuries. In fact, there is a religious dimension to this, but it comes from an unexpected angle. Muslims argued that the Quran is the most beautiful book in the world. Among its other, obviously, it's the ultimate divine revelation, but it's also aesthetically the most beautiful book in the world. And it's not that it happens to be the most beautiful book in the world. There will never be a more beautiful book than the Quran. And that means that the language of the Quran is the most beautiful language in the world. And Jews felt challenged to demonstrate that whatever Arabic can do, Hebrew can do, maybe not better, but as well. And so the writing of secular poetry in Hebrew by Jews in Muslim Spain actually has a religious dimension. So if you read a poem by a Jew in Muslim Spain, which deals with drunken parties has sexual motifs, some of them particularly problematic for Jewish law, And you then say, well, this was written partly out of a religious motive. You won't be wrong, because this was a way of demonstrating the beauty of the Hebrew language and its ability to do whatever Arabic can do. More important, philosophy itself, which was the most elevated of the disciplines outside of Torah, I purposely didn't say secular this time, is extremely religious in its orientation, and yet religiously neutral. What I mean by that is that the medieval philosophers believed that the study of philosophy was a way to understand God better. That if you didn't study philosophy, then you didn't understand God. Nobody can say that this is a secular enterprise from that perspective. However, the issues that the philosophers of the Middle Ages addressed, Muslim, Jewish, a little bit later Christian, were issues that challenged religion across the board. I mean, I have to modify that a bit, but it isn't really necessary for our purposes to do that. There was a challenge to the beliefs of Christians, Muslims, and Jews, many of which were held in common by Muslims, Christians, and Jews, from the philosophy of classical antiquity. So that when people studied the works of Aristotle, whether directly or through various indirect channels, they came across challenges to beliefs that were held by all three relevant faiths in medieval Europe. Was the world created out of nothing, or did matter always exist? Does God know what they call particulars? Or can you demonstrate that it makes no sense to say that God knows particulars, which means even individual people, when you take this to its extreme? This is not a place to discuss the actual arguments behind this in any detail, but just to give some texture to this particular example, God doesn't change. This was accepted by the philosophers of the three religions at issue. But if God knows things that change, then his knowledge changes as those things change. Thus, a few days ago, God knew, I deeply regret to say, that the Yankees would win the World Series. And now he knows, I even more deeply regret to say, that they did win the World Series. That's a change in God. That's a change in God's knowledge. It would appear to be a change in God's knowledge, which is a change in God. My distinguished brother-in-law, David Schatz, who was a philosopher, told me about a Christian philosopher in England who distinguishes between real change and merely Cambridge change. Merely Cambridge change is a change that only someone teaching philosophy at Cambridge would consider a change. But in any case, there are many more examples of this. Does the soul survive as a separate entity at the end of a person's life, or is it subsumed in something larger? Let me leave prophecy out, because Aristotle didn't exactly talk about prophecy, though the issue is interrelated. Does the human connection with some sort of divine overflow happen as a result of intellectual achievement? Or is it connected with moral behavior and an actual choice on God's part? And on and on and on. There are a whole series of issues where traditional beliefs, the instinctive beliefs of traditionalists, were contradicted by what people believed to have been compelling philosophical arguments. Jews, Christians, and Muslims were in the same boat for the most part with respect to these questions. And so there was a kind of commonality of culture that stimulated the Jews in Muslim Spain to engage with cultural activities that are, as I described it earlier, outside of Torah, narrowly conceived, even though they regarded this as Torah indeed. And we'll see that, I'll elaborate on that in a minute. There is one other point that I just want to make about the distinction between Ashkenazim and Sephardim on this issue. I haven't said anything really directly about Ashkenazim yet. And that is that in the Muslim orbit, the language of culture and the language of the street was the same. Arabic was the spoken language. As of around the year 1000, Arabic had become pretty much the language of discourse. Now, there's a difference between the register used in the language of the street and used in the language of culture. But if you lived in those areas, you knew Arabic, and hence, once you learned an alphabet, and learning the Arabic alphabet is not as easy as learning the Latin alphabet, but still, once you learned an alphabet, the high culture was open to you. In the Ashkenazic world, which is the world of Christendom, the language of culture and the language of the street was different. The language of culture was Latin. And so Jews who knew the French of their environment or the German of their environment did not know the language of high culture. They couldn't read anything, even if they learned the alphabet. They would have to decide to study Latin. And that requires a step that requires real motivation. Moreover, and this does get us to Ashkenaz in direct connection with what I said before, the culture of Christian Europe in the formative period of Ashkenazic Jewry, 10th, 11th centuries, was primarily a religious culture. You can find the elements that we might consider secular, but essentially it was a religious culture and was consequently kind of off-putting for Jews who were, in those days, by definition, religious Jews. I'm going to have to qualify this when we get back to Ashkenaz, but it's still, on the whole, I think, true. Now, the decision to study the culture of the surrounding society, and in particular, the study of philosophical works, leads to more than a decision simply to learn something new. I've already indicated that what is at stake here is a conflict between deeply held religious beliefs and arguments against those religious beliefs that seem to be based on reason. And so we're not just talking about study. We're not just talking about absorption. We're talking about engagement. We're talking about acceptance and resistance simultaneously. And it can mean rethinking one's understanding of certain aspects of Judaism. Is it really required that a Jew believe X or Y? Does one have to believe that the world was created out of nothing? Maybe belief in the eternity of matter is acceptable in Judaism. Does one have to believe that God's providence is extended based purely on moral behavior, or maybe it is connected with intellectual achievement? You have to rethink these issues. And on the whole, I think the process is one in which people weighed the strength of the argument against the traditional, let's say, to stack the deck, the naive traditional belief, against the weight and centrality that any particular individual would assign to that belief. In other words, if you believe something and you find an argument against it, and you're not a person who simply says, I don't look at arguments against it at all, what you end up doing on some level or other is weighing the force of the argument against the centrality of the belief as you see it. You will be much more likely to modify an initial instinct if you regard the argument as very powerful and the belief as less than central. You'll be much more likely to resist if you regard the belief as central and the argument as less than compelling. If you regard the belief as central and the argument as compelling, then you have the most acute sort of problem. And these are, of course, issues that exist to this day among people who do engage arguments, not in our day only philosophical, but sometimes historical as well, sometimes scientific, whether it's the literal understanding of Genesis versus evolution, whether it is certain perceptions of human decision-making affirmed by many scientists and the parameters of free will, whether it is historical arguments regarding that challenge traditional beliefs, and you know, to give you an example of the different types of arguments or of processes, if an Orthodox Jew is faced with a historical argument against the validity of something in the Torah, then he or she will and should resist the argument at least initially, forcefully, and if an answer is not easily forthcoming, then to ask the question of whether there is a legitimate basis for reinterpreting what the Torah seems to say. And if the conclusion is no, then you live with a question. On the other hand, with respect to the historical arguments against the duration of the Second Temple for 420 years, which is the standard number given in rabbinic texts, and one that is not accepted by academic historians, the committed Jew might very well decide that the argument is compelling and the belief is not central. And therefore, this is a belief that can be modified or rejected without rejecting the system as a whole. There's a dialectic that's at work here, which operates over a significant spectrum. And the examples demonstrate the complexity and the challenge of this entire enterprise and indirectly demonstrate why there would be people who would be opposed to studying this material on the grounds that it can lead to heresy. Now, for Maimonides, the study of philosophy was not only permissible, it was not only Torah, it was actually the summit of the Torah. It was the ultimate study of Torah because it got you to understand God best. Though, even the Rambam, I don't have time to read you evidence of that, although it's central throughout his work, including the Mishnah Torah, by the way, not only his Guide of the Perplexed, but if you look at the first chapters, the first four chapters of his code of the Mishnah Torah, you find that the secrets of the Torah are physics and metaphysics. At the same time, here is the Rambam writing to the rabbis of southern France in a famous letter that is probably authentic, even though some people have questioned it. They wrote him about how enthusiastic they were about his Mishnah Torah. And this is what he writes to them. Before I was formed in the stomach, the Torah knew me. This is based on a biblical verse, but not the Torah knew me. God says, and the Rambam says, before I was formed in the stomach, the Torah knew me. And before I came forth from the womb, she dedicated me to her study and appointed me to have her fountains erupt outward. She is my beloved, the wife of my youth, in whose love I have been immersed since early years. Yet many foreign women have become her rivals, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. He's talking about secular studies. The Lord knows that they were not taken at the outset except to serve her as perfumers and cooks and bakers, rakachot v'tabachot. Nevertheless, the time allotted to her has now been reduced, for my heart has been divided into many parts through the pursuit of all sorts of wisdom. Now, the Rambam didn't take back his basic ideology when he wrote this, but you have this kind of almost atavistic, nostalgic eruption of a commitment to real Torah. Even though he, if you asked him, is philosophy real Torah, he would have said, you bet it's real Torah. It's a capital R of real. Unlike the study of the Talmud, which is a smaller matter. He actually cites a Talmudic passage that no other medieval Jew took literally. That the Talmudic discussions of Abaye and Rava are a small matter, and the account of creation and of the divine chariot, which he understood to mean philosophy, physics and metaphysics, are a great matter. And the Rambam simply codifies this. Yeah, this is great, this is not. Now, in the second half of the 12th century, Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews met. And they didn't just meet in the arena of books. They met, they really met. And I think that makes a big difference. We now know that Ashkenazic Jews did read Sephardic books even before the second half of the 12th century. But there is a dispute among scholars about the degree to which they were affected by this. I think they were affected very little. The fact that people read something doesn't change the basic way that they think, at least not readily, at least not in one generation. But in the second half of the 12th century, the Jews of southern France, who were primarily of an Ashkenazic profile, and Jews of Spain who were fleeing northward from the conquest of Spain by the Almohades, where Jews weren't allowed to practice Judaism, really met. And here, there is a profound interaction in which Ashkenazic Jews, at least in southern France, this doesn't affect northern France or Germany, but southern French Jewry, a segment of southern French Jewry, becomes enamored of the works of the Rambam, initially his code, but ultimately his philosophical works as well. And by the 1230s, three decades or so after the Rambam's death, there erupts a controversy, which historians usually call the Maimonidean controversy. There was more than one phase of it, where southern French rabbis are extremely unhappy about the influence of Maimonides' works. They believe that that people reading them are affirming what they consider to be heretical views, that the story of Cain and Abel never happened, and so on. There's a pun in one of these documents in which the story of Cain and Hevel is just a lot of Hevel, which means, you know, nonsense or vanity or emptiness. Really don't. For a reason that has nothing to do with this conversation, I just happened to mention this word to some people in shul this week in connection with a medieval Jewish polemical text where a Christian is quoted as saying that a verse in Isaiah that uses the word for betray five times must refer to the five wounds of Jesus. Bogdim bagadu, beged bogdim bagadu. And he asks, where else do you find the same root five times in a biblical verse? This is too much of a setup, but that's what it says. And the Jew responds, Havel Havolim Amar Koheles, Havel Havolim Hakol Havel, which means vanity of vanities, said Kohelet. Vanity of vanities, all this vanity, referring to this Christian's argument. So there is a sense that the study of Maimonides' works leads to heresy. For the most part, Maimonides is not accused of heresy. Maimonides is, there are intense disagreements with quite a number of things Maimonides said, but they are usually not couched in quite that personal a fashion. And in fact, the leading anti-Maimonist, Rabbi Solomon ben Abraham of Montpellier, writes in the one letter of his that we have that he studies Maimonides' code in his yeshiva with his students, and they try to defend Maimonides' views whenever possible. This dispute resulted in the burning of Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed and the first section of his Mishneh Torah by Christians in the early 1230s in southern France, an event that historians used to think led to the end of the controversy because Jews were so horrified by it. Actually, not all Jews were so horrified by it. These were intense controversies, and there were no doubt Jews who thought that this was not such a terrible thing at all. But eventually, Nachmanides and others intervened and came up with some level of compromise. But as I said, this erupted again in the 14th century with changes, though one of which is that Maimonides is now a heroic figure, even to the so-called anti-Maimonists, who consider him above the fray, but the study of philosophy is something that leads to terrible consequences. Let me give you one sentence of the passions evoked by this controversy. I'll read you some stuff written by the Maimonist side, by the pro-philosophy side. By the way, it's very important to realize that this is not a debate between people who consider themselves defenders of tradition against heresy and people who are, kind of less religious. The Maimonists, the philosophical party, considers the non-philosophers to be people who are distorting and undermining Judaism. Who believe that the God is not completely spiritual, but has bodily characteristics, who are enemies of Judaism. Here is one quotation from a person who was initially against philosophical study, but then moved to the other side. He talks about people who refuse to examine a rational argument or to accept it. Rather, they call one to whom God has given the ability to understand rational principles a heretic and non-believer, and his books they call external books, because they do not have the spirit needed to understand a rational principle. This is the nature of the rabbis of France and Germany and those who are like them. And in another passage, some Maimonists in Narbonne sent a letter to Spain describing the French rabbis as fools and lunatics with clogged minds who are devoted to superstitious nonsense and immersed in the fetid waters of unilluminated caves. So when you see modern Jews yelling at each other, you should know that this is a well-developed Jewish tradition. Now, Ashkenazic Jews were not quite as closed as I indicated earlier. They did have discussions about the meaning of the Bible with Christians. This is well attested. It may be that one of the practices of the so-called German pietists, namely acts of penance, physical self-mortification to atone for sin, may have been influenced by Christian behaviors. We now know that certain popular Jewish rituals carried out by both men and women probably developed an interaction with Christian society. And as I will note again later, interest in the natural world was something that was unselfconsciously pursued in Ashkenaz. Maybe I should really say, make a point now. It was specifically in the context of the Sephardim, when there was a dispute about the propriety of secular learning, or whatever you want to call it, even science became an issue. Because for the philosophically oriented medievals, the study of science was part of the progression that led you to the study of philosophy. And so even the study of the natural world was sort of tainted. It was a kind of, you know, backwards contamination from philosophy. I once wrote that that since science was part of the studies that led to the queen of the sciences, the reputation of science was tainted by the not-such-good reputation of the queen herself. But in Ashkenaz, this wasn't an issue at all. I mean, what can be wrong with trying to understand how nature works, even though the mode of investigation was much less sophisticated and all-embracing. And so we come to early modern times. This is what I've described now, with a great deal of oversimplification, is the legacy of the Middle Ages. Now, when you get to early modern times, you will also have differences. Remember, the Jews were expelled from Spain. So there's no longer a Spanish Jewry. There's no longer an Iberian Jewry. The Jewry of the Middle East, which is what Sephardic Jewry sort of becomes, the term that we use, is now living in an Islamic world that is no longer intellectually stimulating. The Islamic world has reached the stage in which it is no longer at the forefront of philosophical or scientific activity. And consequently, the Jews living there are not stimulated to pursue this sort of study. They still value it in theory. They still speak about a chacham shalem, a person who has a broad command of the philosophical and Torah curriculum. But they cease to be creative in the area of philosophy and science. Italy, as we get into the early modern period, is actually a place where you have probably the most positive attitude toward an engagement with the outside world. In this case, it's a Christian world, but a much more sophisticated Christian world than existed in the 11th century. I was once struck when Rav Aaron Lichtenstein at a Gush dinner said something that I told myself no Rosh Yeshiva in the history of the world could ever have said at an event run by his yeshiva. And then I said to myself, no, it could have happened in 16th century Italy, and only there. What he said, there was, and Natty Helfgott, some of you no doubt know, was getting an alumnus award at the Gush dinner, and Rav Lichtenstein was speaking about his qualities. He was then a teacher in a high school. And Rav Aaron said, as Aquinas said, teaching is the ideal harmonization of the active and contemplative life. The only place where such a thing could have been said by Rosh Yeshiva before the late 20th century and only in Gush was 16th century Italy. Early modern Ashkenaz, which is essentially centered in Poland, was actually a bit more open than the way I've described it, maybe not altogether fairly, with respect to the Middle Ages. So that the greatest Jewish decisor in Poland in the 16th century, who was cited by Rabbi Soloveitchik a few moments ago, the Ramah, was open to philosophical study, though it was a kind of tamed, domesticated philosophical study. But it was philosophical study nonetheless, to study the works of Maimonides. He had a dispute about this matter with the Marshal, who denounced him for, I won't go into detail, for citing some philosophical source, and the Ramah said, well, you know, I study this stuff only when other people are taking walks on the Sabbath and holidays. As we move, so if you look at Jewry, as you move into really modern times, That is, as you move into the 18th and 19th centuries. The legacy of secular / philosophical study has been constricted. As I said, Sephardic Jewry now lives in an unstimulating cultural environment. Ashkenazic Jews had never had a strongly positive attitude towards this. After the 16th century, whatever positive residue there was recedes. And again, the Jews of Eastern Europe, remember, which is where the bulk of Ashkenazic Jewry lives, also are not living in a particularly stimulating intellectual environment. The scientific revolution, although initially affecting Eastern Europe, Copernicus, of course, was a Pole, is essentially a Central and Western European phenomenon. And there aren't too many Jews living there. Even into the later period, Darwin doesn't affect Eastern Europe that much, and that's where the bulk of Jews live. So that neither Ashkenazi nor Sephardi come into the 19th century confronting genuinely modern culture. There is a certain discontinuity with the medieval tradition of openness, though that discontinuity itself was caused by historical factors, not just by ideological conviction. It's not that people sat down and said, what should my attitude be toward the philosophical traditions represented by Maimonides, and after careful thought, they decided they don't like it. This is a change that happened, I think, as a result of the historical development that I just indicated, that I just traced, however superficially. Late 18th and 19th centuries, the Jewish Enlightenment arises. And it's an interesting phenomenon because, on the one hand, the early enlightened Jews, the early Maskilim, are citing traditional sources for the value of what you can call, I suppose, by now secular learning. But the argument takes place in a social environment where this movement is seen as a rebellion against traditional society. And to a degree it is. Naftali Hirsch Weisel, or Wessely, who was an associate of Moses Mendelssohn, wrote a polemical work called Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, arguing that Jews should embrace the decree of the Emperor Joseph II of Austria to open schools where Jews will learn secular materials. Wessely was a religious Jew by any reasonable definition. But his work was seen as a wedge intending to undermine traditional Jewish education. And he made some mistakes, some tactical mistakes. It was not the best idea to take a Talmudic passage that says that a carcass is better than a Talmudic scholar who doesn't have judgment. Apply that to anyone who doesn't have a secular education. Rabbis who didn't have a secular education didn't tend to embrace him after he wrote this. And he didn't have to write that. Still, we're dealing here with a much larger issue. I don't have time to engage the question of the Gaon of Vilna, except to say that he is a person who was famous for valuing studies outside of Torah narrowly conceived, but his worldview was not a modernist worldview. And so he was used with some justice by people on both sides of this debate. Maskilim saying, look, the Gaon is quoted as saying that to the degree that you are missing one measure of the study of the wisdoms of the world, you will be missing 100 measures in the study of Torah. While a traditionalist said, you're trying to turn the Gaon of Vilna into a Maskil, and that was the last thing that he was. Then, we do have a kind of reinvigoration of the affirmation of the value of secular learning in a quintessentially religious, orthodox religious environment. And that, of course, is the school of German what historians sometimes call neo-orthodoxy. Rav Shlomo Shneur Feil Hirsch, even before him, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Rav Israel Hildesheimer, Rav David Zvi Hoffman. There is a small but very important and clearly orthodox movement that valued this sort of thing. And here, as I said earlier about the Haskalah, that its profile was determined in people's perception by its social setting as a kind of rebellion against the traditional society. Here, neo-orthodoxy, although I don't like the term, is a rebellion against Reform Judaism. And therefore, its religious bona fides, its religious legitimation cannot be subject to question. What has happened in certain circles in the 20th century is that this legacy is reinterpreted in circles that are opposed to secular learning as a compromise where the bearers of this movement, of this tradition, themselves allegedly didn't really regard it as an ideal, but regarded it as an unfortunate necessity. We have lived through, I don't have time to pursue this, all sorts of revisionism that is ultimately not defensible in trying to deny the existence of such a thrust. And so let me conclude by saying a word or two about the field that I study, and that is academic Jewish studies. We've talked about secular studies, about philosophy, and compared with the study of Torah alone. Where does academic Jewish studies fit into this? It's an interesting hybrid, and I think, to my mind, it's one of the most important intersections of the world of Torah and the world that is nowadays in certain circles called Mada. In circles opposed to this enterprise and secular studies in general, even the study of the history of Jewish thought is perceived as a non-Torah pursuit. Yet without such study, we can't make informed decisions about the proper parameters of legitimate positions within Judaism, an issue that is Torah par excellence. Here are some almost random examples of the sort of fundamental questions I have in mind. And these are questions that can be answered, by, can be dealt with, can be confronted by somebody who studies in a yeshiva only, but they rarely are. And to do them right, you have to have the tools of the academy. How have Jews through the ages approached the authoritativeness and interpretation of Agadah, of Kabbalah? How have mainstream Jews related to sectarians? How have they related to non-Jews? What is the relationship between the Rambam of the Guide of the Perplexed and the Rambam of the Mishnah Torah? Is Da'at Torah, that is the ultimate authority of rabbis, or Torah Umada, a new term for a venerable belief, or is it largely an innovation? And I ask that about both of those terms. What can the history of Jewish messianism teach us about contemporary messianic expectations? How have Poskim dealt with the challenge of historical change? And then there is the study of cultures and disciplines with direct bearing on the understanding of Torah. Can recent literary approaches provide enriched insight into biblical narratives and perhaps even a new strategy for responding to biblical criticism? Can ancient Near Eastern texts or the literature of Greece and Rome illuminate difficult terms or passages in the Bible or Talmud? Obviously, I think that the answer to all these questions is yes, that the academic study of Judaism helps to address some central questions in Torah. Now, that doesn't in any way deny the fact that such pursuits can be religiously dangerous. I don't argue that decisions made on this level are simple decisions in terms of what sort of education one should pursue and what sort of education one should have one's children pursue. I will say, and I thought of saying this last night when I was in bed, and I said to myself, maybe I shouldn't say this because now I'm a dean at Yeshiva University, and this is kind of special pleading, and so on. But I will say that if one wants to engage these questions and these challenges and embrace the study of the cultures of the world, and at the same time do so in an environment where the profound both social and intellectual dangers, and they are both very real, will be minimized without, in my view, compromising the positives. There's one place and only one place in the whole world to do that. Very good. Okay.
Thank you very much. Oh. Okay. Is your first one solid? Oh, no questions. Okay. No? Sure.
No. I said Rav Shlomo ben Avram of Montpellier. Actually, when my daughter was in what in those days was called Central, the Yeshiva University High School for Girls, she told me that she was studying, she was taking a Jewish history course, and the teacher had said that Rabbi Solomon ben Abraham of Montpellier, the anti-Maimonist, was the Rashba. And I told her that it wasn't the Rashba, that the Rashba was Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, who lived in the early 14th century and was very involved in the next stage of the Maimonidean controversy. Very involved. And how to characterize his position is a matter of great interest. But the person in the 1230s was not the Rashba. And this was an interesting test of how important or unimportant I think my field actually is. The question was, should I be an interfering parent and somehow get in touch with his teacher and tell him that he had misinformed these students? Or should I say, it's not a good idea for parents to interfere and cause trouble with a teacher. And after all, will the world come to an end if these kids think that this was the Rashba? Maybe the world would come to an end, but I decided to keep quiet. And God validated this decision. I have to be a little careful about this argument because one of the Detroit newspapers in the 1930s, when Hank Greenberg decided to play on Rosh Hashanah in the heat of a pennant race after much agonizing, public agonizing, and hit two home runs, one of the papers in Detroit said that God had demonstrated that he had made the right decision. So I have to be a little bit careful about such deductions. But God demonstrated that I made the right decision because my daughter told me that during the review at the end of the term, before the final, the teacher corrected this error. So I was quiet, and the world didn't come to an end after all.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay.